make a change for once in my life.
Welcome to Make the Change, your weekly dose of inspiration for creating positive change in your life. Learn how changing your thoughts, feelings, words, and actions can lead to the life you desire and deserve. No need to go it alone. Let us become part of your journey to get from where you are to where you want to be. Every Saturday at noon, the show's host, Patricia Terrell, and her fabulous guests will lead you with a weekly prescription to invigorate your mind, body, and soul. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with Make the Change.
Welcome to Make the Change Radio Show, your weekly dose of inspiration for creating positive changes in your life. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell, and I'd like to thank you for taking the time to tune in today. Well, it's that time of year when parents and children begin to focus on back-to-school activities, and that includes taking the necessary vaccinations to immunize your children from vaccine-preventable diseases. For many parents, getting their children vaccinated is more of an inconvenience of juggling doctor's appointments and taking off work. However, some parents do not want their children to receive vaccinations due to personal beliefs, and some opt out of immunizing their children altogether due to medical reasons, homeschooling, and more. So today we're going to address every aspect of the vaccination and immunization program for back to school. And we're also going to talk about vaccinations for adults, such as the flu, shingles, and pneumonia vaccines. And what you will find interesting about today's show is that we're going to share the history of immunizations before vaccinations ever came into existence. Now, due to a scheduling conflict, internist Dr. Willarda Edwards and Byron Soji Thomas of the Health Policy Research Consortium are unable to join me live in the studio today, so we recorded the show instead of rescheduling. Since many students will begin school next week and promotions for the flu, pneumonia, and shingles vaccines are in full swing, we want to make this important information available to you right away. However, Byron Soji Thomas and others from HPRC are on standby to address your questions via Twitter. So we want you to address your questions for today's show via Twitter. We're trying something new via Twitter at HPRC_info. Again, that's HPRC_info. And you can also send your questions via Facebook and type in Health Policy Research Consortium. And while you are there, be sure to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Now, if social media is not convenient, you may also call me here at the studio at 1-800-450-7876, and I can get your questions into the right hands. So why don't we get started? Dr. Edwards, welcome to Make the Change Radio Show, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I am Willarda Edwards, and I am an internist in Baltimore, Maryland for the last 32 years. And I am also the medical officer to HPRC, Health Policy Research Consortium.
Okay, thank you so much. And Byron Soji Thomas, tell us about yourself.
Hello, everyone. My name is Byron, and I am the Deputy Director for Health Policy Research and Analysis at HPRC. And as Patricia said in the opening, we do public policy and its connection to your health. It's good to be here.
Great. Now, we're doing a slightly different show today, and we're going to allow people to send their questions via Twitter and Facebook. So, Byron, why don't you let us know where they need to direct their questions? What is your Twitter page?
We are at HPRC_info.
That's HPRC_info. That's your Twitter account. And then we're also going to ask people to post questions via your Facebook page. Give us your Facebook URL.
So if you go to Facebook.com, type in Health Policy Research Consortium, you will see us pop up.
Okay, great. And like we said, we wanted to do a live show, but Dr. Edwards is on travel and we were not able to coordinate everything. And then the school year is starting really soon. So we wanted to get this show in before you actually had to get your children vaccinated. So why don't we get started and we'll just open up the show with a very important question I was confused about. about it, but what is the difference between vaccination and immunization? They seem to be used interchangeably, so I want to make sure we start off with a clear understanding of the difference between the two.
Okay, so you can take a vaccine to get yourself immunized. That is to say, you can take a vaccine to protect yourself against infectious disease. When you protect yourself against infectious disease, that is the process of being immunized. That is building up a defense, an immunization to the disease. So the vaccine is the actual shot that'll help you do that. The immunization is the process of defending your body against the infectious disease. So, for example, your body has a natural immune system. So your body can make a product inside of itself to defend you against disease. But there are things that your body cannot do to protect you, which is why we need vaccines to help to defend your body from infectious disease.
Well, you just answered my first question about why we need vaccines. But help us to understand, what diseases or disease did the first vaccine prevent?
Well, the first vaccine was created to treat smallpox, which, as it turns out, was a massive problem for humankind for millennia, actually. It was a century after century, millennium after millennium, till a British physician named Edward Jenner found a way to immunize people against smallpox. And in just about 100 years after that, we came to a place in medical care and public health where people decided, okay, we've done so much with saving people's lives with this vaccine. How close are we to completely ridding the world of smallpox? So in the late 1960s, an American physician named D.A. Henderson convinced the major public health experts in the world to design a campaign that over X number of years would rid the world of smallpox. And so they designed the campaign. And so from the mid-1960s to the late 1970s, this campaign went on all around the world. And by 1980, the world was declared free of smallpox. The only place you will find smallpox now is in a vial in a lab somewhere in secret, just in case somebody decides to do something foul or nefarious, or somebody wants to make war with it. But the world is completely free of smallpox. And many people don't know smallpox would do to a human body because it's been gone now for a whole generation. But you can go online and look for old videos or old photographs of people infected with smallpox, and you'll see how terrible the disease was.
Yeah, I did have a chance to visit the website. You provide a lot of links, which I will share and upload to my webpage, that provide pictures. And yes, I'm so thankful that we do have a vaccine to get rid of smallpox. But let me ask this, what were they doing prior to the smallpox vaccines? Dr. Edwards?
Very interesting history about smallpox. The fact is that people were, centuries ago, in China and in Sudan, they were using what we call inoculation as opposed to a vaccine. And with the inoculation, just to describe it, was that they would take some of the scabs from the healing smallpox scabs and grind them into a powder and then use that to rub into an open sore to create what is now called just inoculation. And that did help to decrease the number of people who were dying from the smallpox. But that we're talking about centuries ago, and that this was something that was done centuries ago. And as Byron has pointed out, Dr. Jenner then created something from the pus from cowpox to create the vaccine that was used then for eradicating smallpox in the population. So that was a move from inoculation to then vaccination. And that's where we are now. And as opposed to using the pus, a lot of things now are being made from chemistry, the wonderful science of chemistry, and how we can now be more sanitary, of course, in our trying to produce the vaccines that'll be helpful for all of the inoculations or the vaccinations that we're doing now.
Wow, that's an interesting history. I had no idea that that's what took place. So let's talk about how successful vaccines have been in the past and even now as a tool as it relates to public health.
Yes, so starting with the smallpox vaccine, over the decades, the public health community and the medical community realized how successful these were. So medical science began to look for ways to protect people from any number of infectious diseases. So if we take measles as an example, when the measles vaccine was first developed in the middle of the 20th century, it was officially licensed in the early 1960s. And, you know, it became widely available across the U.S. and around the world, actually. So from the time it was licensed in the U.S. in the early 1960s, there were maybe about 400,000 to 500,000 cases a year in the U.S. By 1990, that number had slowed down to maybe less than 20 cases a year. So in the matter of about a generation or so, we reduced the number of measles cases in the U.S. from close to 500,000 a year to only about a couple dozen a year. And in fact, we had gotten to the place where it was almost gone until we got to a situation where there were a few people who thought the measles vaccine was not a good enough idea for their children to be immunized, so they don't send their children to get the shot, and the disease came back, and that's how we got the outbreak recently in the last couple of years. The same is true for the polio vaccine. Again, in the middle of the 20th century, the vaccine became available, and we are almost rid of polio like we were rid of smallpox. Polio is now only found in two or three out of more than 200 countries in the world. And in those two or three countries, it's because of war situations and conflict situations where the warring parties don't allow people to come and get their shots. So it's only in those two or three countries that you can find polio. Now, so vaccines have been wildly successful in not just preventing disease, but increasing life expectancy.
Are they mandatory? When we think about people who have children going to school, do schools require vaccinations before they allow these children to enter school?
I know that Byron can speak to the policy aspect of that, but just to make sure that people recognize what has been already said, and that is that the incident that we had with the recurrence of measles, that was an incident that people can probably remember, that being the Disneyland episode out in California, I believe it was, and then also the mumps that came back as a result of someone in the group that was the hockey team, I think it was, that had all of a sudden an outbreak of mumps. But that's where policy, and that's what Byron can address, is very important with respect to getting everyone immunized because of the community immunity that we want to seek and to have. And that is creating more people who are immune in the community. That creates less opportunity for disease to occur and then infect people who may not be immune to something.
Okay, Byron, what do you say?
Excellent point. So what happens when you take vaccines is the best case scenario is if you have an infectious disease you want to protect people from, you want to make sure you get the vaccine to everybody who could potentially be exposed. Anybody who could potentially catch the disease, you want to make sure that person gets the vaccination. When you do that, if you're dealing with an effective vaccine, and typically they don't license vaccines and put them out if they're not effective, we go through rigorous clinical research to make sure that we get as close to 100% effective as possible. Sometimes in the course of developing the vaccine, you don't get to those high numbers above 85, above 90, above 95%. But typically before vaccines are made available in the market, they're pretty effective. So the idea is to get to a place where as many people as could be exposed to the disease you want to prevent, as many people as could be sick from that disease get the vaccine. When that happens, there's an immunity for the community that Dr. Edwards was talking about. In public health, they call it herd immunity. It just means that...
Herd, that's H-E-R-G.
H-E-R-D, herd. It just means that most of the people in the population, preferably all the people in the population, are now immune. So that if the disease comes back looking for somebody to infect, it goes looking around, it doesn't find anybody, so nothing happens. And so the public policy aspect here is first committing the resources to doing the research. What research? Well, first the research about the disease. What is it? Where does it come from? What causes it? Where can you go to stop it? When somebody catches the disease, what happens to their bodies? Okay, we need to do that research. And then the research on the other side, how do you stop those effects if somebody were to catch the disease? Once we've done that and the vaccine is developed, there needs to be policy that says, okay, this vaccine is now available and we need to get it to the people that could potentially be sick. Well, how expensive is it? Can people afford it? If people can't afford it, who can help them afford it? When it's time for people to get the shots, can they get it at school or can they get it at work like we do with flu sometimes? Or can you go to the pharmacy or can you go to your doctor or can you go to the hospital? Depending on how many people could be exposed, you need to set policy that says, okay, we expect this, you know, like the flu, there's a flu season, There's this part of the year where we expect more flu than others. We call it flu season. So before the flu season starts, we need to make sure that we've produced enough of the vaccine, enough doses based on scientific research we've done about how many people could potentially catch it. So you say if 20 million people could catch the flu this year, there are 20 million vaccines waiting. The policy says here for kids to get their flu shot, they can get it from the pediatrician or they can get it at school. For adults, the workplace could get a nurse to come to the work site and give out the vaccine, or they could go to the CVS or go to the Walgreens and stand in line and buy the vaccine there, and the pharmacy would administer it that way. So the policy is that, okay, we have this vaccine available, this many people could get sick, this many people could die if they're not protected, so make sure they go to the places where they live their lives to go get the shot. So that's what the policy aspect of this is.
You said a lot there, so let me see if I can break some of that down. You said herd immunity, and that's basically the masses. Basically, is that what you mean by herd immunity?
Yes, it means that you have given enough vaccine so that enough people in the community are now immunized from this infectious disease.
Okay. Is it mandatory for children to be vaccinated before they enter school? And I know it may vary from state to state. So why don't you start with the tri-state area here in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia?
Yes, well, schools require it because if an infectious disease breaks out because there's a child who comes to school unprotected from a disease and therefore catches that disease, by definition, if it's infectious, that means the child can spread it. So if the child comes with this illness into a crowded environment like a school, if there are 1,000 kids there, now you have the potential for spreading it to 1,000 people.
Even if you've reached that percentage of vaccinations that reach that herd immunity of 85 to 90%, is the risk still there?
Well, the risk goes up if another child, let's say most of the children in a given school are protected because they have taken their shots, right? But now you introduce into that community a child who has not taken their shot and therefore is potentially infectious. If everybody is protected, fine. But if there are one or two people who are not, those one or two people could potentially get it from this child who is not protected. And then that could then, those people, if they travel, could take it to someplace else and it could spread that way.
And that's if that child is infected at some point. That's the...
Exactly.
Right, that's the...
But that's what the school is trying to avoid.
Right.
The school is trying to avoid a situation where something is introduced into the population that shouldn't be there and it spreads and it becomes a hassle and sometimes potentially, depending on what the disease is, it could be potentially deadly.
And as you know, we're getting a lot of people who are very opposed to vaccinations. They've linked vaccinations to a lot of illnesses and also they've had some side effects from the vaccine. But let's just stick with the schools and the students for now. Now, let's say we have a mom who is very concerned about getting her child vaccinated. What are her options?
Well, you know, the schools are typically very strict about this, that, you know, Maryland law says if the school says you should be vaccinated and if you have a known allergy to the vaccine, then obviously you shouldn't be taking it.
So that's one. If you have a known allergy to the vaccine,
that would be one reason to exempt you, because if the vaccine could potentially kill you, then
mm-hmm.
obviously you shouldn't
okay.
be taking it. Another could be a religious exemption. If you have a religious exemption, then you would decide not to take the vaccine. But in either of these cases, Maryland law requires, and that's the same for a lot of places, that you sign a waiver that I understand the risk of exposure to this disease. I have opted not to take it because of exemption ABC. And you sign it and it's filed somewhere where people can get it. Because sometimes if there's a disease outbreak, part of the investigation that public health folks need to do is, well, where did this come from? Who was the first case that began to spread it? So so data like that becomes important in terms of investigating where the outbreak started so you can know how to stop it at the source and begin to...
So that child who wasn't vaccinated will be one of the first that will be investigated if an outbreak were to occur, chances are.
Yeah, and then, you know, we don't want people to get the idea that this is like a law enforcement thing, you're investigating a murder.
Right.
We want people to understand that when infectious disease outbreaks happen and people are getting sick, and if this is a disease that could potentially kill you, if the outbreak happens, there's detective work that public health people do to find out where did it start.
Absolutely.
Because you need to know where it starts.
Absolutely.
Because that can help you, for example, find out, A, where did that person catch it? B, did that person catch it in spite of having a vaccine? C,
where else have they been and who else could they potentially have infected?
Mm-hmm.
It is not that you're trying to find a way to get somebody to end up in court and
Absolutely.
End up in jail.
Yes.
It just means...
Thank you for clarifying that.
It just means that you want to investigate it so you can solve the problem, which is all these people getting sick from this thing that we can prevent with a disease, with a vaccine.
Okay, so with the exemptions that you just mentioned, religious, allergy, then would that student still be permitted to go to school? I think you said yes.
Well, the laws and policies vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Depending on what the disease is and what the school district would like to do about it, there might be various things, various approaches. Some might say, well, don't come back until you've got it because this is a disease that we think is serious enough that everybody needs to be protected. Or they could say, well, since you've signed the waiver, we have this waiver on file and we know what to do if there's an outbreak. But most of the schools are pretty strict and they'll just say, well, you can't come to school unprotected because of the potential of exposing others.
So homeschooling is an option?
Homeschooling is an option.
And that's pretty much it?
That's pretty much it.
Okay. Dr. Edwards.
Yeah, could I just want to say that with respect to the community, or I'd say community immunization or community immunity versus herd immunity, because I'm talking about people, not herds. But the fact is that it's about being... The policy is there in order to protect the community in general. And as we talked here today, that we have some people that will get immunized and then some folks will have reasons why they don't want to or can't have the immunization. And it's those people that are unable to be immunized that we really do want to have the community looking out for them, essentially. There are some people who are immunocompromised. And what do I mean by that? There are several reasons why people might have the inability to protect themselves against infection. Some people have a genetic disorder that they were born with and therefore are unable to really become immunized, even though you may give them a vaccine. There are others who have acquired the compromised immunization status. People who have things such as diabetes, HIV, and also cancer, leukemia, or lymphoma, and chronic diseases, as I mentioned about diabetes, and people who have renal failure, who have kidney failure, and those who may also be on medications that they need, like steroids or chemotherapy when they're being treated for cancer, or are being treated with a transplant, trying to prevent them from being their rejection of their transplant. So they may be given medication that then suppresses their immunity. Those are the people that we want to look out for. And so we want to make sure that we don't inadvertently infect them. Pregnant ladies may also be immunocompromised as well. And so when we think about our reasons for not being vaccinated, we need to also think about we're in the community and we do not want to expose people who are unable because of their health reasons, because of their genetic makeup, because of their being with child status, then be compromising them or infecting them.
And I thank you for that clarification because that's so important. And I'm thinking that what they need to do is make sure that they consult closely with their physician.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, and watch their travel in and out of the state and be more diligent about sanitation, exactly. Washing their hands and the like.
Absolutely.
Okay, so why don't we look at anything else that you want to add, Dr. Edwards, regarding the age groups? Like say, for instance, now we're approaching flu season. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we should know about getting prepared for flu season?
Well, we also need to make people very aware. I think the public health, the authorities and policy has made it very clear that the kids should be immunized from the very get. We know that between the ages of 2 and 4, 2, 4, 6 months old, they should get their diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, polio, and Haemophilus or HB influenza vaccine. Then they should also have their shot for pneumococcal, in a cough or pneumonia that people may hear about, and then the rotavirus. There's also a need for the age 12 that people will get, the kids will have, 12 months rather, the kids will have their pneumococcal shot, the measles, mumps, and rubella, and also the meningococcal shots. These are all shots that kids get between the age of birth, 2 months, and then 12 months of age. And this is routine.
And they're not all done at the same time. They spread these out over...
over months.
Wow.
Over the 12 months of their...
That's a lot. Yeah, and then it would seem like it would make it difficult. I guess that's why they have to spread it out, just to make sure that if there is some sort of reaction, they can know which one may have been the cause.
That's true.
That's the case.
That's true. But it's wonderful the fact that we can, that these are routine, and if the mothers are able to get their kids to see the doctors, or parents are able to get the kids to see the doctor on a regular basis, those shots are going to be done routinely. But then when we get to past the age of 12 and 18 months, then there's that concern of, as you go into your adult years, everyone should be getting their tetanus shot as well, and parents and mothers should be getting tetanus shots with every pregnancy. Then that child will be immune to that situation when they're first born. But every year after age 5, every 10 years after age 5, you should be getting a tetanus shot, tetanus diphtheria shot. And everyone should, at any age, be getting what is now required, and that is a re-immunization with the tetanus diphtheria and pertussis, or Tdap is what we call it in the internal medicine, adult medicine. And every 10 years after that, you should be getting a TD, tetanus and diphtheria shot, to avoid tetanus, which is a terrible disease, which we hope we never have.
Well, yeah, I can understand both sides, and I think basically what we're saying, that prevention is better than the risk.
Absolutely.
That's involved.
Yes.
So on that note, why don't we take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk more about vaccinations, immunizations, and again, joining me is Dr. Willarda Edwards and Byron Soji Thomas, both with Health Policy Research Consortium. We'll be right back.
If you live in Prince George's County, Maryland, listen up for this important announcement about how you can gain access to resources that can improve your health. The Health Policy Research Consortium, also known as HPRC, has a mobile app called Health Connect Prince George's that can help you find local resources such as farmers markets, parks and hike trails, recreation centers, community health centers, hospitals, pharmacies, and much more. The Health Connect Prince George's app is available for download on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. You can also visit www.hprc.info. That's www.hprc.info, and click the links at the bottom of the page. Download the Health Connect app today to connect you and your community to a healthier tomorrow.
Welcome back to the second half of Make the Change Radio Show. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell, and today we are talking about vaccinations and immunizations, and joining me is Dr. Willarda Edwards with HPRC and Byron Soji Thomas with HPRC, and we're talking about policy as it relates to vaccinations and immunizations, and Dr. Edwards is going to talk about some of the medical aspects of vaccinations and immunizations and how they impact us on an individual level. So let's get started. And we talked about Health Policy Research Consortium, your role as public policy and making sure that you handle the research findings and report your findings. Why does HPRC care so much about this whole issue of vaccinations and immunizations, Byron?
Well, simply because vaccines usually prevent disease for pennies on the dollar or dimes or nickels on the dollar. It's a great way to prevent infectious disease, and it's always better to prevent infectious disease and to wait until an outbreak occurs, and then you're trying to protect and treat a whole number of people. So if you can prevent it at the front end, that's a great way to prevent a predictable disaster, because some diseases can spread really quickly and cause a lot of trouble in a hurry. And so we care because it's always better, especially since for preventable diseases, if we get as many people as possible immunized, then we don't have to worry about these outbreaks. So from a policy standpoint, what we do in public policy is, okay, ask questions like, okay, how many people could potentially be infected? Do we have a way to protect them? Do we have a way to prevent them from exposure to whatever this disease is, whether the flu or measles? And then we need to ask the questions, okay, how much will it cost to do the research to find out how to create this vaccine? Okay, once the vaccine is developed and ready for the market, how do we make sure that everybody who needs it can get it? How do we make sure people know about the disease, the vaccine's effectiveness? How do we make people know how this vaccine can help to protect their bodies from this disease? And then where do we disseminate the vaccine? Is it from hospital? Is it doctor's visits? Can you get it at the CVS? Can you get it at school? Once you've done that, how do you do the public education to let people know that you're putting yourself and others at risk if you don't get the shot? That's all what we concern ourselves with in public policy, to make sure that we're taking care of each individual so that we protect the population at large.
And you also post your research findings on your website. So why don't you give them the website where they can go and learn more?
HPRC.info. That's HPRC.info.
Okay, so let's talk about, how did the immunizations come to be in terms of who decides which vaccinations are important and which diseases are most important to immunize against?
Okay, Byron? So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta is the federal agency that does the most work in America with helping to protect population health. That is anything from infectious disease, that is what causes them, what kind of effects it has on the body, how many people get it, what is the difference between the races in terms of, do more Asian people get it versus of African-American people, to how many ages get it. That federal agency is in charge of making sure we know which infectious disease we should be protected from. They have a special committee called the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practice, which every year sets up a schedule for immunization. So the schedule is in different age brackets. So they'll have one for children, they'll have one for adolescents, they'll have one for adults, and it'll have a schedule of which vaccines at each age group you should be taking, how often you should take them. And that schedule gets disseminated to public health agencies, local health departments, to physicians' offices, so that everybody knows this is the schedule you should follow. And then the state departments of health and public health authorities in your state and your local, in your county and in your city, they will take this schedule and look at the recommendations in them and use that to guide their own policy.
And they're pretty much standardized across the country?
Yeah. I mean, once the medical research is done that says, okay, this vaccine will protect against this disease, it has to be standard. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, you run into problems.
Okay. So let's talk about when vaccines fail and someone does have an adverse reaction to the vaccine. Dr. Edwards, can you chime in as to what happens? Is that person now going into the CDC records, or how are they treated?
Yeah, any time that there is a bad reaction, or in this case with vaccines, a non-reaction where there's non-immunization, anything that happens that is adverse with respect to the medicine that's given has to be reported. And this is generally reported. And it's wonderful that we have policy that requires this reporting, because as Byron has said, then this is the way that when it's reported, like to the CDC, or the fact that we have an advisory committee on immunization practices that reviews every year what the immunization standard should be and what should be given on a regular basis, and makes that uniform across the country, then it just makes it that much easier for us when there's a problem or an issue that's reported, then that data is then collected, and then we can then try to narrow down what the problem may have been. Was it that particular batch of the vaccine, or was it just a community? If there's an outbreak, is there a community source that is causing a continuous outbreak in that situation? But because of policy, which is what we emphasize at HPRC, that is, the data's collected and we can do more research. We think about it in terms of trying to help the community in general, as opposed to really trying to find a culprit, so to speak. It's not about that. It's about trying to create a better community immunity in the case of vaccines, and then be able to do better research and then be able to provide the research and information that's needed in order to improve the situation.
Yeah, and you said something very important, that vaccination does not guarantee immunity.
Good point.
And so sometimes that's a result of...
Well, the fact is that all of the vaccines that we have developed, in some cases, people may not develop their immunity. They're not always 100% guaranteed. In some cases, could be 70% or 90%. And that's why in many of the vaccines that we have available, there needs to be repeat. And most mothers will know that they need to have their kids getting the vaccination a couple of times before the immunization is built up and they become immune or protected from the disease. And that's the reason why in many cases, such as tetanus, you should be getting a shot every 10 years after you've had all your shots from birth to 5 years old. Then I tell my patients, if you got your shot at 5 years old, remember on your 15th, your 22nd, your 35th, all of those five birthdays, you should always get another tetanus shot.
Wow. Throughout life.
Throughout life.
Okay, great. Do vaccinations cause autism? Is there a link to autism? So I'm going to start with you, Byron. Can you talk about that? Because I do know that there are some people who have concerns and have actually indicated that they believe that is to be the case. What do you say?
Well, the short answer is no. There have been a lot of studies done that have shown that no, vaccines do not cause autism. Dr. Edwards has some more detail on that.
Yeah, 18 years ago, The Lancet, a read medical journal, published an article from Dr. Andrew Wakefield, a UK or British gastroenterologist, a GI doctor, who studied and claimed that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine was associated with autism, and also he said Crohn's disease. As a gastroenterologist, he would comment on that. It was found that later on that much of his study was fraught with fraudulent data and unfounded claims. And in spite of that, I mean, that really in 1998 was when this occurred, and it just poisoned the well. And more people were withholding vaccinations from their kids and themselves, and that's when we saw a major increase in 1998 and beyond with measles, mumps, and rubella, and more of vaccine-preventable diseases were occurring. We've tried to eradicate that, like try and get a vaccination for that, try to eradicate that poisoned well, but there's still some people that will always say that they don't want to have vaccines given to their kids. And the fact is that that's the most recent one. That was 1998 when people put up this about autism. But for years, I'm talking about centuries, people have always, just as we developed an inoculation, people would say, well, that's not God's will for you to be inoculated by the disease that you're being affected by. And the fact is that's not science. And the science now, as I mentioned earlier, was the fact that we now use vaccines that are not built from the disease itself, but usually just from something that will help create more antibodies to whatever that disease might be. And there are also some issues about the preservatives used in it. And most vaccines now don't have preservatives in it, so people don't have that necessary reaction to it. And that's part of where people may think that, well, I get the flu shot and I'm going to get the flu.
Thank you for clarifying that one. That's big one.
Because you don't have in that flu shot an active virus. There's no active virus in it. It will cause you to create more antibodies. But if you get any type of flu shot and you get some sort of cold symptoms, in most cases it's going to be very mild, and sometimes that's what it's needed in order for you to build up an antibody or defense against that particular virus.
Well, thank you. I think you just cleared up a big myth for me, because mm-hmm. I always thought they were injecting us with the influenza virus as a vaccine.
In the past, there were some situations where that was done, mm-hmm. but now we don't need to do that anymore.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was vaccinated as a kid, and I'm sure that the reward outweighs the risk. So let's talk about one that I want to talk about, too, is we're going to talk about shingles. We're going to get that out of the way, because that's the new vaccine mm-hmm. that's being publicized mm-hmm. Right now. So who would like to open up with that one in particular?
Well, with respect to the shingles virus and the shingles shingle vaccine, rather. That, just to say what it is, shingles is usually, it's disease that occurs as a result of people having been exposed to having chickenpox. And once you have had the chickenpox and the virus goes back up into your nervous system, into your spine, and then as you get older and your immunity kind of lessens, and you may, under some stressful situation perhaps even, then have that virus come back out to the skin surface, and it will be follow along a nerve, what we call the innervation of a nerve. And so you see it'll follow like a line pattern, whether it's on your face or whether it's on your back or arms or legs, it follows a little streak. And the fact is that can be, herpes zoster is what it's called, can be very, very painful. In some cases, people will have it, it'll last for weeks or months in some cases. And then if it does go away, when it does go away, in many cases, you still have residual pain from that in that area. It's like phantom pain, as some people describe it.
Yeah, I've heard it's very painful.
Yeah.
Terrible to look at even.
It's very terrible to look at. And when that, because it can be so bad, and we then found in the last 5 to 10 years of vaccine that can take care of that, that can prevent the painful disease of shingles. And so subsequently, people are being told at age 50 and definitely at age 60, it varies as to when you should get the vaccine. But if you want to avoid having shingles, then you want to get the vaccine, and it has been very much effective. And again, the issue is that not all vaccines are going to be effective. It may not take in your individual case, but if you get the shingles once, you can get it again. But if you get the vaccine, that then deters the possibility of you getting it repeatedly.
Okay, great. So why don't we give them again the Twitter page and your Facebook page, so if they have any questions regarding anything that we are discussing, they can definitely present them via Twitter. Let's start with Twitter, Byron.
Yes, so Twitter, our handle is at @HPRC_info. And on Facebook, once you log into Facebook, just type Health Policy Research Consortium, and consortium is CONSORTIUM, and that's where you'll find us on Facebook.
Okay, great. So we have just a few more minutes, so why don't we also maybe have you, Dr. Edwards, talk about some of your patients' experiences are, what their concerns are, that may help some of our listeners.
As an adult, and I think we've talked about this, the fact is that people should always get their tetanus shot. People should then also get pneumonia vaccine and also the flu shot on an annual basis. And the reason why you need to do that is because the flu virus changes from year to year. And so that's why in the fall, typically, we will give people the most recent developed and anticipated virus and vaccine against the particular virus that we think will be occurring for the winter season. And so subsequently, we ask people to get their flu shots. Also, you should get the pneumonia, and you can get the pneumonia and the pneumococcal shot, as well as the flu vaccine at the same time in most cases. And the fact is that vaccines are very expensive.
I was just going to ask that, and I was going to let
And
go ahead,
it's
please.
Expensive for people for physicians in the community to maintain them sometimes in their office. And so now we hear that people are being sent to the pharmacy, where the pharmacy will then have that on stock. If I get a number of tetanus shots in my office and they're not being used because my patient population doesn't need it for the next 10 years because I gave them all out, that's going to sit up on my shelf and be expired by the time I get somebody to use it. And that's an expensive thing to expire, whether it's that or the shingle shot that we've talked about. They're very expensive. My patients are being encouraged, and many other community physicians are encouraging their patients to go to the pharmacy and get those shots there. We may sometimes have them get the shot and bring it back to the office where we can give it to them. But sometimes it's a lot easier for them to just get it once at the get the medicine and then get the shot there in the pharmacies. That's where policy is very important with respect to vaccines, because of the fact that, as we've talked about, the fact that kids will get their shots when they go to their pediatricians. It's required before the school year. But once you get out of school and then get into college, where meningococcal vaccine is suggested for college students, we get away and we then get into our business of living and then providing for our kids and making sure that they get all the things they need. And sometimes the adults do not get the instruction or the requirement to have those shots. Health professionals are required to have flu shots and other things, but what about everybody else? And that's where we need help from everyone and the public in general when they talk about public health, because sometimes I may offer it to my patients, but because they haven't been getting that education and they didn't have to do it because they had to be in school or in college, then they think, well, I don't really need to have that. So public health and public education is very important in creating a community immunity, and we really want to have that going forward, and that's why we push policy and creating more education and research on immunizations.
Great information. And so, Byron, I want you to speak to the fact that, okay, so we have the pharmacies, we have the doctor's offices, but we also have like mobile units that are available as well. Can you speak to that?
Well, yes. In some communities, the local authorities think that if we don't send a mobile unit out, if we don't get the vaccines out to the people, then they will, either because of access issues or money issues or transportation issues, will not get the vaccine. So maybe we take the vaccine out to them. That's the logic there. But as Dr. Edwards has said, public policy has developed because we have had the bad experience of trying to treat people at the back end of an infectious disease outbreak. It's a bad experience trying to fix that at the back end when you have multiple hundreds or multiple thousands getting sick. Think about, for example, what happens sometimes when people eat bad food and you get this outbreak from bad food and a lot of these people are getting sick and you want to go find out what batch of bad food did they buy. Was it chicken or was it spinach? Or was it a bad batch of eggs? You know, we don't yet have vaccines to prevent against that, but we have vaccines to prevent against other infectious diseases like the flu, like measles, which can be just as deadly. The flu actually kills people. So people just need to understand that there is a reason why we prefer to prevent a predictable crisis, because we know that the crisis is in fact predictable. If enough people get sick, we have a crisis on our hands. And if we have a predictable crisis and we have a way to prevent it, then by all means in public health, we believe we should prevent predictable crises.
Yeah, and I do recall the meningitis outbreaks that have occurred on these college campuses.
And meningitis can kill you.
And can kill you, definitely, yeah. Be very debilitating. So yeah. I agree, even though I do have my reservations, anytime someone's injecting anything, I personally have reservations, but I do agree with you that vaccinations overall are necessary to protect us. And so what I'd like to do, you know what, another question, you talked about how expensive it is on the doctor's side. I didn't even get to cost. I mean, how expensive is it for parents and to get their children vaccinated? Any idea?
Well, it's hard to answer that question because there's a variation there. Mm-hmm. If you have a vaccine that was developed in a way that makes it easier to price it at a lower price point, then that's the situation. If the research was very difficult and it was hard for the science to catch up to how to protect people, then the vaccine is probably going to be expensive. The key is that local and state and federal authorities understand what these diseases do to people. We know how many people on average get disease A every year or disease B every year. So based on that, you know, public policy tries to work in a way so that as many people as could be exposed to a particular disease can be able to afford some kind of way. If they can't afford, they'll find a mechanism to help them afford it. So cost, when you're trying to prevent an infectious disease, is an issue. So when we're trying to prevent a disease that could potentially kill people and potentially kill a lot of people, if there are cost issues, public policy tries as best as possible to find a way to help as many people afford it as possible. Because the goal here is to avoid avoid an outbreak, right? So if you have a disease that's expensive and so many people who could potentially be exposed cannot afford it, then we have a problem. Then, you know, what was the point of developing the vaccine anyway? So if that is the situation, then local and state and federal authorities will come together to find a way to help people afford it. So for some vaccinations that are pretty standard, if you are covered by health insurance, your health plan can help you afford it. It'll be a subsidized cost for you. It'll be, if you buy it through the plan, it's a subsidized cost. And so typically there are ways around the cost issue. And so the cost should never be a barrier per se. Even if it's a barrier, it's a barrier we can get around.
Okay. Dr. Edwards, would you like to weigh in on that?
The fact is that with the Affordable Care Act, that emphasizes the fact prevention of disease and coverage for prevention. And many people now didn't have insurance, now have coverage, certainly through the medical assistance programs that they may have across the nation. And the immunizations are part of that preventive policy or preventive measures that we have under the Affordable Care Act. So while we definitely will have that coverage for the students that are in school and in colleges, they do have access to that for the most part via their insurance and their coverage that they now have. The same thing with our adults that are over 65. Medicare now covers that, their immunizations as well. And so there shouldn't be that fear about whether or not they can afford to get the shots as well. And we're really glad about that because vaccines overall are good for your children, for your family, for the community in general. It's good for all of us.
That's a great way for me to segue in and start closing the show. We only have a few minutes left, so I will leave the final minutes for both of you to weigh in on some final points that you want to relay to our listeners. Byron, I'll start with you.
Yes, well, thank you, Patricia, very much for this important conversation. Remember that if you can prevent an infectious disease, if you can avoid catching something, we all ride the metro. Many of us are in the grocery store. There are any number of crowded places where you can be on a day-to-day basis where you could catch something because you don't know what the next person is carrying. And so to the degree that you can take vaccines to prevent that kind of occurrence, which, I mean, you have no idea who you're riding the train with, you have no idea which doorknob you're touching, who last touched the doorknob, you don't know. But if it's a vaccine-preventable disease and there's a vaccine you can get, you should take it.
Okay, Dr. Edwards?
I want to encourage everyone that if they have a primary care provider or healthcare provider or physician, that they talk with their doctor about their status in terms of their status on immunizations and vaccines. As I said, the vaccines are good for children, for the family, for all of us, for the community. And the more protected you are against preventable diseases, vaccine preventable diseases, the better. And it's real important also for people to recognize that they need to keep up with their schedule. A lot of folks are now traveling in other countries, and they may not have the same coverage in the other countries. And so it's real important for us to be immunized, even when we do travel around the nation and internationally.
Okay, great, great show, great contributions. Thank you so much. I'm sure that a lot of the questions that our listeners have about vaccinations, immunizations, any concerns, I think you have properly addressed. So thank you, Dr. Walada Edwards, for joining us. And Byron Soji Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Again, you can direct your questions to
HPRC_info. That is our Twitter handle. And sign in to Facebook if you wish. Health Policy Research Consortium.
And if you care to send an email, if you can't remember all of that, you can send me an email at pat@patriciaterrell.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners out there. I'd love to hear what you thought about the show. Send an email to pat@patriciaterrell.com. You can also visit my website at www.makethechangeradioshow.com to listen to this show and previous episodes. Be sure to tune in next Saturday for more lively discussions about how you can make positive changes in your life.
Remember to tune Tune in to Make the Change every Saturday from 12 noon p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also visit with Patricia at www.patriciaterrell.com for links to social media, email, and blogs. Thank you for listening today, and remember that changing the world starts with changing you.
The research and information that we report during today's broadcast was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD00860802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.